Thanks to DigitalOcean for sponsoring this week's episode of Does Not Compute. DigitalOcean is the simplest cloud platform to run your applications and effortlessly scale them as your business grows. From a powerful administration dashboard to robust compute, storage, and networking solutions, DigitalOcean provides an all-in-one cloud platform to help you save time and money scaling your applications. DigitalOcean services have predictable, affordable pricing, so you don't have to work around complex pricing structures that can have nasty surprises at the end of the month. You'll always know exactly what your business is going to pay for DigitalOcean's industry-leading price performance with a flat pricing structure, and that includes all of their global data center regions. I've been using DigitalOcean ever since they started with their insanely affordable $5 a month droplets, and these droplets are no slouch either. This is a solid-state-only server with a gig of RAM for just $5 a month. It's crazy. Their tools and server performance have only gotten to be a better value over time, and I don't see why that's ever going to change. So if you're thinking about trying them out, we actually got a little deal for you. You can get started today with a free $100 credit at do.co/doesnot. You can have a real virtual private server running in just a few seconds, or thousands if you want. Again, that's do.co/doesnot, and you'll get $100 of credit towards a flexible and scalable hosting solution for your next application. So we're going to start a new show.
What show is that?
It's called the Sean Rockwell Typing Mechanical Keyboard Show, and it goes something like this.
I didn't have very much to say, so I just typed drive.google.com instead.
What are you rocking over there for your keyboard?
I am rocking a Razer Black Widow Tournament V2 Chroma, 10 keyless.
Oh, is that the one with the crazy rainbow colors?
Yeah, you could do that if you wanted. I just have it set to white. And actually, this is kind of cool. I have everything set to white, including my mouse. I have a Razer mouse as well. All my peripherals are Razer. And the only keys that aren't white are the H, J, K, and L keys and the escape key. And those cycle through the spectrum.
Nerd. That's really awesome.
I like my Vim key bindings. So it's not even like the color helps because I don't look at them. You obviously just feel around for the little nub on the J key.
I like to see you play like PUBG with Vim key bindings for arrows.
Yeah. I mean, I've just been playing, that would be real bad because I'd have to use my mouse left-handed. But I've been playing Scum. I don't know if you've heard of Scum. It's interesting. Interesting game.
No, what's that?
It's, have you ever played DayZ?
No, I haven't.
It's basically a survival game. So I'm trying to think how I can frame this. I hear like all a bunch of our listeners rolling their eyes like, oh, don't talk about video games. But this game is very, very interesting. So it's a survival game in that, well, the backstory is that you're a convicted prisoner, like you're a prisoner. And so it's basically like Hunger Games. So all these prisoners go to this island and it's like televised because there's these little drones that fly around with cameras. And so you kind of show up there with nothing but your clothes. And so you can run around and you can like pick up rocks and make like a stone knife, and you can use the knife to maybe make like a wooden spear. And you basically run around. There's towns on the island, and there's they call them puppets, but they're basically zombies. So when a prisoner dies, they get reanimated, I guess, as like a zombie, and so they're kind of roaming, and you have to protect yourself.
Okay, cool.
But you also have to. It's like a free for all, so it's multiplayer. So you can get on a server, and people can be nice to you, so they can like friend you up, or they can take everything from you. So I got mugged a few times, even though one time I just laid on the ground and I used my proximity chat, which means that people near you can hear you, your voice chat, and I pled for my life, but they didn't have it. They weren't having it. So.
That sounds like online gaming in a nutshell.
Yeah, pretty much. A lot of it sucks. A lot of the people kind of aren't the nicest people, but the game is fun. Well, we're talking about keyboards, right? Yeah. So I just have a Razer. I think the keys I have are yellow, so they'd be equivalent to like a cherry red, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've got the blues here. I've got a CM Storm. Also, I think you said 10 keyless, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't stand the number pad. I need that space for my mouse. But yeah, I don't know, man. The linear kind of actuation of like the reds and the like the clears and stuff, man, I don't like that. I need a little click, a little bump, give me some tactile feedback.
Yeah, I like the red. I don't really like that click. Well, first of all, it drives Jamie insane, and She's been working so much, I wouldn't put it past her to actually end my life if I were to use these blue switches. Yeah, she's in her last year of law school, and she's on the journal, so she's having to basically approve citations and prove people's work, which seems terrible. It'd be like being a senior engineer, right?
Well, at least she'll be able to defend herself in court when she murders you.
Yeah, probably. Or cover it up. I don't know. She watches a lot of those crime shows, so maybe she's been studying. But yeah, for my safety, I use the non-clicky, so to speak, keyboards. And I have more. I have a poker, a Vortex poker, which is like a...
Nice, I heard of those.
Yeah, it's like a 60% keyboard, I guess. So it's like 10 keyless, but it doesn't have the arrow keys. It has... layers. So if you wanted to use arrow keys, it's actually, I think it's I, J, K, and L are the arrow keys if you hold down a modifier key on the keyboard. And then I have a Vortex Core, which is like the worst. It's like a 40%, so it's barely usable, but I have one. And then I have a, what's the other brand? Not Cooler Master. The other brand, Corsair. I have a Corsair wireless as like a backup. It's got Cherry Reds in it. So it's a backup for my, my Razer keyboard.
When do you smash the keyboard and the keys go flying everywhere?
Well, one time I dropped like a whole cup of water on my keyboard, my Razer. So that's why I have the backup. Luckily, I just let the Razer dry for a couple of days upside down and it was fine.
You ever have any quality control issues with the Razer? Like, I know I got a Razer mouse and it just crapped out on me instantly. And I was like, I'm done with this brand. And I don't know.
No, I haven't. It's been great. I have a Death Adder Elite, which I use mainly. And then I also have a Basilisk, I think, that Jamie uses when she plays. She plays Path of Exile sometimes with me. But yeah, so mainly Razer peripherals. I don't know why. I just like the aesthetic. It's just everything's matte black.
Yeah, and blinding LEDs.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's the other one that I said I had? I'm struggling today.
The Corsair,
yeah. The Corsair looks like... It's like plastic, but it looks like brushed metal. It's so ugly. It's so bad. It's like, why would you do that? Just make it matte black and then people will buy it.
Yeah. I guess it's Cooler Master. I didn't think of that. CM is my kind of main one. I've got on my PC over here, I've got a Unicomp Model M clone, which is like, you know, Unicomp. Have you heard of those?
I have not, actually.
So IBM used to make the famous buckling spring keyboard, the Model M. Right, every old
I've heard of that
clicky computer, and it's a sound that you can recognize, and it was actually patented, so like no one else can make this style of keyboard. But the people who at IBM, somehow they got the patent from IBM and started a business called Unicomp just to make buckling spring keyboards because they have the rights to do it. So they have all kinds of variants of it. I have a Mac variant, so it has like a command key and stuff, but. Uh-huh. Oh God, it's weighs a million pounds and you could probably kill somebody with it and it just sounds great, but you think the cherry blues are loud, like your neighbors will hear this. It's that bad, but I love it. And it's also, it's awful for your, if you have any RSI or carpal tunnel issues, would not recommend. Once I started using that for too long, when I get into cycles of being really, really productive and doing lots of development, my wrists start to not feel great. So I actually have one of those Microsoft Sculpt ergonomic keyboards, one of the previous gen one that doesn't have the number pad, and that's wireless. And you know what, like once I got used to the ergonomic, you know, positioning of your hands, it's actually really, really nice, dude. Like, you know, it's no mechanical obviously, but man, it's such a load off your wrists.
Yeah, I actually have a Sculpt as well, and the only reason I haven't been using it or I stopped using it was because every now and then, and it was more often than not, there would be latency when I type, and I couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, I was worried about that too. It wasn't enough to bother me. For gaming, well, I'm bad at games, but if I was good, it probably would be a problem.
Well, I mean, I would type a whole sentence, and it would be like 2 seconds, and then the sentence would type itself, basically.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, so I haven't ever had any RSI problems. I don't know why that is. Like, a lot of people that I know, including you, have had kind of wrist issues or RSI problems or, you know, tightness and kind of pain, and I've never dealt with that. But I have, so when I first started touring, I went from playing pretty often to playing 3 hours a day, every single day. And that's like rehearsing and practicing, and I wanted to keep my job, so I played a lot. And my wrists didn't really hurt, but my elbow and my left arm, because I play a guitar, I'm right-handed, my left arm would be just in agony.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so they call it like tennis elbow, I guess. But basically, my wrist and my arm muscles tightened up so much. So I don't know if it's... Do you have any sort of like stretching routine or like warm-up routine for your wrists before you start working?
No, I don't. I just try to always keep them elevated. You know, I never set them down, but that's really the only thing I do to prevent it.
Do you have a wrist rest for your keyboard?
No, wrist rests are evil.
I don't know. You have RSI. I mean, that's a mean thing to say, but...
Well, no, I always understood that you're supposed to keep your wrists elevated so that they're kind of free to move and you're not, you know, stretching your hand into positions that it shouldn't be. I mean, the QWERTY keyboard is bad enough.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know. That's what I always heard. But
yeah, I don't know. I like my wrist rest, but also YouTube drummer stretches. Those will fix you right up, I think.
I'll check that out.
Yeah, drummer stretches are a big one because I used to do that. I was actually playing a show somewhere and... This isn't really into drumming stretches, but this is how I got on my path to flexible wrists, I guess. I was playing a show and I was complaining about how bad my arms hurt or my arm hurt. And somebody overheard me and they were a carpenter. They just happened to be at the show. And he was like, let me see that arm. And so you grab my forearm. And so if your palm is your thumb's facing the ceiling, your pinky's facing the floor, there's kind of like on the top of your forearm, there's a muscle there in a tendon, it feels like almost. And if you kind of put your thumb there just below the ditch of your elbow, you can feel it and you move your thumb left and right. I want everyone at home to try this right now. You can feel the muscle and tendon kind of sliding back and forth underneath your elbow.
If you're driving, don't try this, please.
Yeah, don't try this. Well, yeah, don't do this. You can try it with your knees. I've seen people do that, but don't do that. That's bad advice. Yeah, so move your thumb left and right, and you can feel kind of like the tendon and the muscle moving back and forth. Now, if your arms are tight and your wrists are tight, it's going to hurt. It'll hurt. So if you push down on that, it hurts really bad. But if you really kind of grind into that with your thumb, that'll kind of release some of the pressure and the tightness in your arm. And anyway, that's what I would always do. So when my hand and my arms would get tight from playing, I would just massage it out like that. And it's kind of the same idea as like maybe a foam roller or like a lacrosse ball for your back or something like that. It's kind of the same thing, but that's one thing that I do. So I do drummer stretches and I do that whenever my arms are sore. So jujitsu is a lot about hand strength and gripping. And sometimes my wrists will get sore from that. And usually it's referral pain for me anyway. Some people can have actual structural problems like structural pain. But for me, like my back problems have always been my legs being tight. So it's like a referential pain. And my wrist problems, if I had any, were usually from another muscle in my arm being tight that was pulling on something and I felt it in my wrist. Anyhow.
Anyhow. We got really off topic there.
Yeah.
Well, it's relevant. It's still relevant.
Maybe that helps somebody. Maybe it makes something worse. I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
You got to try these stretches.
Yeah, that's what works for me. Yeah, what were we talking about keyboards. I mean, that's tangential to programming. I don't know. I use Vim Mode a lot and I do a lot of like keyboard, I customize a lot of my keyboard shortcuts too. So for example, I'm never reaching for the escape key. I remap KJ to escape in Vim. So in all of my editors, I do that. So I basically mostly always have my hands on the home row.
I know you can, in Mac OS, you can actually remap caps lock to be escape as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like right in the system preferences, which is a common thing to do. I haven't tried it yet, but...
You haven't? Oh, I live by that. I live by that, especially in Windows or Linux, because control is everything in those two operating systems. So, yeah, I always, no matter what keyboard, and Razer, I do it in the Razer settings, and my Mac, on my laptop keyboard that I hate so much, I do it in the OS settings. But yeah, that's one thing that I always do is always caps lock to control.
Caps lock to control. Oh, okay. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, because I never really use, I'm not really shouting at anybody ever.
Okay, so here's the real question. In first-person shooters, control and shift, which is crouch and which is sprint?
C is crouch and shift is sprint.
Okay. I'll allow it.
You'll allow it?
I mean, yeah, shift has got to be sprint for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Programming, let me think. What have I been doing? So just debugging bugs today was crazy. I had run across this crazy bug with Axios where I won't go into a bunch of details about it, but basically the gist of it is that the bug would be if you're trying to create like a specific instance of Axios so you could kind of avoid any sort of globally set common headers on Axios. So for example, if you wanted to have a route that you needed to maybe delete a session or something, log somebody out, you wouldn't necessarily need to send a bunch of other headers there. So you could just create a new instance of Axios and use that. But there happens to be a bug where sometimes those headers get copied over to the new instance, which is not great.
Yeah, thanks JavaScript for, you know, being able to mutate objects and not really even be aware that you still have reference to it. I mean, I guess that's a problem in any language that you where you have that, but it seems especially prevalent in JavaScript where you've got objects for everything.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. It's even more interesting because I haven't been in JavaScript land for a while. I haven't really done anything with Nuxt or Vue because I've been doing mostly all backend stuff. And I'm getting more and more into Elixir land, and I come back to JavaScript, and it's a, not a bad world. It's just a different world. Things are different. So it's interesting. It's been interesting listening to you talk about the last couple of weeks, talk about Nuxt and talk about your kind of like performance experiences with dynamic module registration and kind of how you're fixing it up. And I think last time we had talked, you mentioned how you're kind of like creating little controllers instead.
Yeah. So that's actually what I've been doing. And I've actually got it in a pretty good spot where I like it now. And I was just sending you some snippets today and slowly realizing that I just basically recreated most of the Vuex on my own. Yeah. So what I ended up doing was I came to this weird realization when I was trying to describe to you what these little helper objects or classes did. I was like, oh, they're kind of like controllers. And I don't know, that just kind of gets stuck in my brain. I'm like, controllers, controllers, controllers. It's like, I was in this weird thing where I had, it's like the names were starting to collide, right? So in Vuex, like you've got state. And for example, like, so let's say you're talking about a site, a particular remote ham radio site, right? It's just called site. And so like I would pass the site into a component, right? As a prop or whatever. But then I also had something called site, which was like this sort of management class that represented the site, but the data was like also called site. You know what I mean? Like one thing was the state, one thing was the actual like object. And that was getting really, really confusing. And then I came to the realization, well, like, oh, okay, well, I said controller. And well, okay, so if I imagine that Vuex is like my model, like that's the source of truth for the data, and view components are literally views, then what's in the middle? That's a controller.
Sure. Yeah.
And so instead of Vuex modules, now I just have controllers everywhere. And I'm still using Vuex for, like, again, just the source of truth. I'm just using Vuex for state and for mutations. And that's cool because, again, I get all the developer tools.
Yep.
Right? I can browse a state tree and I can roll back time and, you know, play Doctor Strange and whatever. But for everything else, for actions and for primarily actions, really. And oh, and getters, state retrieval as well. Those are all just methods on classes. And I call them controllers. So I've got an app controller. I have like that's like kind of the root that kind of handles all the root state. And then for each site, I have like a site controller. And then even within each site, I've got all the components. And those are just, I just call them components. Right. And again, not view components. They're like hardware components. And that works really, really, really well. And so I kind of have my classes. I literally define getters just like a, you know, get whatever, and then I just kind of wrap up the state, and then when the methods that modify either modify the state directly or they just talk to the socket and send messages off. Because so no longer do my view controllers have any references to the socket. Mm-hmm. They don't have any references to the Vuex store. They don't have any references to my dispatcher, which is used for like wiring up all the events. They just have these controllers, and they just deal with the controllers. And I do have the global app controller that's injected into every component, so I can use that as like my kicking off point. So if I need to, you know, grab stuff from within the components, I could just do that, just like you have a global store, you know, just like that.
Okay, so how was your experience? All right, well, you're not really even done building this thing, so I can't really ask about maintaining it. So far, how has your experience been in working in this kind of this code base every day versus the old one where it was just kind of, I don't want to say jQuery. jQuery soup sounds like a negative term. I don't really want to say like the old one was bad. It's just different, a different way of building something. And the whole idea. So one thing that I kind of think about, like, tools you choose are supposed to make your life easier and they're supposed to help you be more efficient, right? They're supposed to help you, in my mind, like a good tool will help you clock out at the end of the day and not have to worry about stuff or be still be frustrated about things and all that stuff. How are you finding Nuxt in Vue, and like, are you happy you kind of made that choice? I know you have some React experience as well. I'm not like saying that, you know, React is bad or you need to compare it to that, but like, what are, you know, what's your general feeling of how things are going with that project?
So now that I've got the initial, like, I felt like for the past couple of weeks since I've started this, I've been kind of stuck in a refactoring loop, like, because I'm not really familiar with the way I wanted to organize things that was best for my application. And so getting to this point where, like, I'm actually happy with it and I understand how all the pieces work and I can actually start to, like, feel productive in the sense that, like, I can actually start fleshing out the features and everything now that I've got the core functionality in place, mm-hmm. that how I want it. And so that's a big relief now. I know it's performant, right? That was a big question mark. Got that taken care of. I've got things organized the way I want them and to be extensible, so I can just keep adding stuff and I know exactly where everything needs to go. And now, yeah, I mean, listen, it's I've written a bunch of the RHR stuff in React, and now I'm basically rewriting the jQuery and the React parts entirely in Vue. But it's so nice writing in Vue that, like, I don't see, you know how, like, rewriting stuff sometimes it just feels like a slog, like just a waste of time. Like, oh, I already did this, and I have to re-implement it again.
You know, I know about that.
Yeah, maybe once or twice you've done that.
Yeah.
So that's a real downer, but it's just so, I don't want to say effortless, but like, I don't feel like I'm doing any more work than I have to recreate the functionality that I need. And that is enough to keep me going, be like, okay, what's the next thing I need to work on? So I'm very happy with my decision. And I mean, in the long run, it's going to be insanely more maintainable.
Yeah.
It's going to be faster. It's going to be, you know, be able to support the future stuff plans that we have coming down the pipe, which I haven't really talked about yet, but I want to get this kind of done and get those new plans kind of solidified before I talk about it. But we've got some big stuff coming for our company. So this is all kind of prepping for that.
Right. Well, I mean, it sounds like that's about as much as you can ask for and how you kind of describe feeling about it, which is great. I feel more so the same way about the kind of the GraphQL stuff I've been working on. So we've been working on product variants on our back end. And so Paul's been leading that out because I have another project on my plate. And I had a hunch that well, so some people may be like, oh, you don't need GraphQL to do this, but it made doing what we were doing with product variants, because that infinitely makes products and managing products and in that whole flow just more difficult, right? Because before a product was a product, and now a product can have sub-products basically, which are variants of that product, and they can be ordered a certain way, and they can be, you know, like a store can say, oh, I want this one to be eligible for like newsletter digest and this one shouldn't be. So it's just much, much more difficult, right? And so I had a hunch that maybe GraphQL was something that could help us without having to kind of stub out all these endpoints and figure out, because you have to design all the URLs, right? If you're not using, if you're building stuff with REST, you have to think about all that stuff. You know, if you're using something like JSON API, you know, there are ways that you can kind of sideload information and ask for relationships and stuff. But if you're not using a standard like that, and we weren't, you know, you have to think a lot about how are these URLs built up, and it's basically designing another API at that point, right? Because API, I mean, like, in something that somebody else will consume, because the client's going to have to use all of those URLs to build something that's coherent. And it was just a whole loop that we were able to skip. So I figured, like, oh, that sounds like it's going to get complicated. I've been wanting to dig into Absinthe a little bit. So I took a week and I just dumped my time into Absinthe, and I got out some basic queries that Paul could use. And Paul reported back and he was like, wow, this made a lot of things that I was worried about very simple in terms of building the UI that he needed to build to make the management easy and foolproof. Now, like I said, that's not saying that we couldn't have done it with another technology or another, I don't know what you would call it, philosophy, guidelines, standard, I guess, like REST. But yeah, it felt really good because he was able to jump right in and add stuff right away, and he wasn't confused about anything. I gave him one. We had one call where I ran him through everything. He was like, "Sounds good." And the next thing I know, he's added all this stuff. You know,
I mean, that's from a maintainability standpoint alone. If you had to basically define your own query language, basically your own protocol, your own way of fetching related data, like, that's just additional business knowledge that someone needs when they're looking at it. And like, you have to design that.
Yeah.
And you have to maintain it, and you have to document it, and you have to teach it to people who are being brought on board. Like, that's not a good place to be, especially if there's like problems. It's like, you got to fix it. But having a standard that you can just grab and is, you know, well documented and well supported and people know about, that's pretty powerful.
I mean, the tooling is unreal, to be quite honest. Like, there are things like Swagger that you can use to build out documentation about your endpoints, but that's a thing you have to do. And with GraphQL, it just is because the nature of GraphQL, it's like a typed public interface for your data, right? And because it's typed, all these toolings are coming up for introspecting. And so I basically, what I did before I handed it off to Paul was I opened up a graphical instance, and I made a bunch of tabs with basic like example queries, and here's how you can do that, and here's how you can limit. And I'll talk more about that in a second. But yeah, so what I did was I exported the JSON from that workspace and then just slapped it into the GitHub PR. And I was like, hey, check this out. And so he downloaded the JSON, and here is like a workable thing with, you know, the types and the fields are auto-completing and the input objects are auto-completing. And so he's able to see via the documentation, like what actually he can send through and what he can't, without having to ask me a single question, which was huge, I think. So what you kind of mentioned with like this flat structure thing. So I remember we had the whole Hasura discussion a while back, and one thing I liked about it a lot was that it was pretty flat. And while there is something to be said about not having a completely flat structure, so you maybe shouldn't be able to get from point A to point Z from anywhere, right? So maybe there should be some sort of, there's an inherent structure to your data, right? Stores have products, products belong to a store, there's a structure there. But there's also something to be said for having a somewhat flat structure, allowing Paul to get the data he needs wherever he needs it from. And so this is actually really cool how it works. And if anyone's interested, I'll gladly share some code. Just hit me up. But so I started using Data Loader. And the way that things are set up is that I have some interfaces. So I have like a product filter input object, and I have a store filter input object, and I have a pagination interface. And so we have queries for, before we were using like a traditional pagination setup, like what's it called? Scrivener. So you have like current page, page number, you have total results, you have results per page, like, you know, just the traditional pagination stuff. But we also have more of a cursor-based pagination query as well alongside of it that didn't really require me to do any extra work. And the way that works is just Data Loader and pattern matching. So when you're using Data Loader, you register a source, and your source basically is saying, if you're resolving a field called stores, here's how you get a hold of these stores. Or if you're resolving a product or a field called products, which is a list of products, here's how you get a hold of those products. We can pattern match on what Data Loader is sending through to the source. And based off of that, I can use the whole, we've talked about it a bunch of times, the whole reducing a map into basically a single SQL query. And so when you compare that, the reduce with the mapping of params that Data Loader gives you, you can basically write, I made a module that has a couple of functions in it, and then the sources each just use that module, and they're required, so it's basically behavior, they're required to implement two functions. And as soon as the source implements those two functions, you can use any of those filters from the top level query. You can use any of those filters from a relationship. So for example, if you're filtering for products, you can use the product filters on a root product query, or you can use all of those arguments as well on products inside of a store query.
So
that's a lot. I'm sorry.
No, this is really cool because the way you're describing it sounds like when one of the Elixir gurus is describing, like, you ask some really hard thing and they're like, oh, just do this language feature X. And you're like, I've never even heard of that, or I never would have thought of it that way.
Yeah.
Like, you're at the point now where you're just like, oh, I'll just throw a behavior on here and define a module for this. And like no hesitation. It's just fine.
What's funny is it sounds complicated, but it's not, because I took a lot of inspiration from the Inquisitor library. And so my module, my behavior module, is literally just called Query Builder. and it expects you to define a function in whatever is using that module called build query, and that's three. So it takes a query, it takes the key, and it takes a value. So it just, that's all it is. And then there's also another function that's kind of a utility function, and that's, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but basically ordering is really important for Design Collective, and sometimes we need to be able to order by more than one key at a time. And so that's specifically due to product variance. And so before, order key, or order by rather, took an enum. So I was using enums for this. So an example of a sort order enum might be like name ascending, name descending, price descending. So it's basically just an enum full of, you know, the columns or the keys rather that you can use in the direction. So it's just appended. So it's the column name underscore direction. And that's all defined. So, I mean, you can't just send any arbitrary value to GraphQL because it's a numerator. It's set like a defined number of values that you could send. And so what I did was I wrote a function that takes the atom that we get from the enum. So it might be like name underscore ascending. And I split it up into a keyword list that Ecto takes for ordering. So that might, it would come in as an atom value of name underscore ASC. And it gets sent or comes back as a keyword value, ASC colon colon name, for example. And so at first I did it so you could only send one value at a time because I hadn't thought about sending multiples. And so Paul was like, hey, I need to be able to send price and sort index or variant sort index rather. And I was like, okay, well, now I have to change this code. And so what I did was I just wrote another function. If that parse order keys takes a list, then it just maps over that list and calls it again. And so I just have two guards, parse order keys when is list, parse order keys when is atom. And so that literally just spits out something you can send directly into Ecto.
It's funny though, thinking about this as you're describing it, one of the first things when you come to functional languages is like, well, how do you do polymorphism, right? How do you define something that has different behaviors depending on what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in object-oriented programming, you have an object or an interface, and the polymorphism comes from the methods kind of overriding that, or different implementations of you know, child of inheritors.
Yeah, okay.
But you don't have any of that in functional languages in Elixir, but you do have pattern matching. The pattern matching is essentially functional polymorphism.
Yeah.
And like when you think of it like that, it's again, it's changing the behavior based off of what you have, not like an if statement, right? And being able to define it sort of declaratively is just like, you know, so powerful.
It's awesome because number one, that it's a very, very simple implementation that allows us to get that flat structure. So you could do, well, I mean, Absinthe has a thing where it limits, like, you know, because query complexity is a problem or can be a problem if you don't limit that. So someone could theoretically, with GraphQL, go store product, store product, store product, store product, store product, and blow your database up. And so, you know, Absinthe, if I remember correctly, I can link to this, I guess, to the docs, but it has like a complexity limit out of the box. But that's a real problem. I was Googling it and I was like, wow, that's something I never even thought about. With GraphQL, someone could maliciously write a seemingly benign query that would just grind your service to a halt because it's just infinitely nested data, basically. But theoretically, because of data loader and because of this pattern matching module pattern, we could have that work as long as the database didn't blow up. Like you could get the data that you needed as far down as you wanted to.
Yeah, especially with data loader because it batches everything before it fetches it. So it's not like it's just pulling the database forever, right? It knows the IDs that it's fetching before it actually does the fetch.
Yeah, have you ever looked at the source of data loader, the Elixir library?
No, I haven't.
It's intense, but it's not as... I look at it as like some mystical, like, wow, how is this even possible? Ben must be some sort of like genius wizard that was sitting in a tower that wrote this. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, it makes sense. It's like,
well, no, let's not. Ben Wilson is absolutely a wizard. Let's not gloss over that.
Yeah.
Every time I talk to him in person or in chat, my head just explodes a little bit. He's just, I don't know. He thinks about things different way.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess that the data loader library is a product of that, because if I were to try and write something like that, it wouldn't be as simple. Maybe that's a better way to put it, because simple isn't even the right thing way to describe it, because it's still a heck of a thing. But
it's just a pattern, right? There's not a lot to it besides the convention.
Yeah, and again, maybe it's because I think I'm so used to functional stuff now. So like I went to check out Spree like a couple weeks ago, and I was just kind of doing some competitive analysis, and a lot of people are using Spree these days. And Spree is a Rails gem for, it's like an e-commerce kind of thing that you could build a store on top of. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, this doesn't make any sense to me. I was completely lost immediately. And I've made Rails apps. Like I've built multiple Rails apps before, and I was like, I'm lost.
Yeah. I tried to, when I was in between Rails and Phoenix/Elixir, I started using Trailblazer, which is a sort of alternative Rails architecture, mm-hmm. which is supposed to solve all the problems of Rails, make it a lot more componentized and reusable, and has concepts of like cells, which are like view models, and form objects for doing validations and controllers, and operations for like doing, you know, atomized kind of instructions that you can just kind of track errors on and stuff. And it was all really, really nice, but like I kind of just really, really got lost in what I was doing after a while. I just lost sight of the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And what was the point? The point is that like when I came to Elixir and Phoenix, it just made a lot more sense, especially with the way now they organize applications with the separate web and application, namespaces. Oh man, I don't know. I still do Rails for my day job. You know, I mean, I do it a lot. I do it for client work and stuff, and it's still super, super productive in it. It's still great. I still enjoy it. But yeah, the original RHR application that I started, you know, years ago and maintained and was not super experienced back then, it's a pile of hot garbage.
Well, maybe you're too close to it, and that's why it looks like or feels like hot garbage.
Oh no, I won't even let you look at it. It's bad. Well,
there's definitely hot garbage in DK, but this GraphQL stuff has really allowed me to refactor some things that I didn't really think I was able to get to, which has been nice. So yeah, I guess like the whole point of me bringing that up was that it kind of gave me that feeling of, hey, this is gonna be okay. This is gonna work out. Like this was the right choice. And I don't know that I often have that feeling of I made the absolute right choice here, but I think that in this instance, I absolutely made the right choice.
Yeah. I mean, it just takes a while to get to that point, right? You gotta prove it to yourself, and you gotta get some proof of concept that, oh, you know, this actually works. This is going to be okay. Everything will be fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it probably would have been fine before too, but now it's going to be better.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully. I mean, so far Paul's been very productive with it, which is awesome. I mean, it put him ahead of schedule on this variant thing, which is a very, very, very big change. And that's, I don't know, I feel like that's what my job is, right? If there's something that we can adopt that makes the engineers' lives easier and makes them more efficient and makes them feel better about the product they're building, then that's something we want to adopt. And GraphQL was that. And I don't know, sometimes I get hung up on people thinking like, oh, I say, oh, GraphQL is helping me out to solve this problem. And then there's always someone that's like, oh, well, you could have done that either way, you know? But I don't know. I get hung up on that stuff sometimes, but I feel like I made the right decision. And that was part of like, that's what my job is to find something that helps us and adopt it. Like, how can we adopt this? What, you know, what are the edge cases? Is there a better way? That was my Hasura thing. Like, are these kind of as a service things something we can use? And turns out I don't think they are for us. But, you know, I really often or rarely do I feel like I'm doing my job as a CTO, if that makes sense. Like I'm doing CTO work, because a lot of my job is writing help documentation and answering support tickets and sometimes writing code, you know. But I feel like my job as a CTO is more of a like exploratory stewarding the ship kind of thing. And so I think that this is one of those scenarios where I felt like I was doing what my title says I should be doing. I don't know. Maybe I'm off by that, but I don't know. It may feel good.
Well, so what's the next big roadblock you see? What's the next big thing that you're going to road that you're going to have to go down to do some exploration? Do you have any idea? Do you know? Or are you guys pretty set on your terms of like tech stuff so far?
We're pretty set. The only thing we might be adopting soon-ish, and by soon-ish, I mean it could be next week, depending on a call we're going to have, and it could be next month or next year. But Elasticsearch is something that I think is inevitable down the road. I mean, we can get pretty close with Postgres, and we've been doing fine with Postgres, but things keep getting more and more complicated. We want to offer, you know, better searching, faceted searching and stuff. And not Postgres, but Elasticsearch was developed for that reason. It's a very, very, you know, specific tool to solve a very specific need that we have. And yeah, I think, you know, this whole GraphQL thing has been like a paramount shift for us, because we're also using it internally to do things like construct payloads for emails. And so having the ability to kind of build the data structure that you need when you need it, and not have to build a bunch of extra functions elsewhere to kind of massage data, because you already did it with GraphQL and your resolvers, right? It's kind of been a huge thing. So it's kind of working its way through a bunch of parts of the application. But I could potentially see that helping with how we're building indexes as well for Elasticsearch. But yeah, so Elasticsearch might be, you know, something we're taking on, but
that's a really interesting idea. And like, I know Elasticsearch is one of those things that's like big enough and popular enough, and it's been around long enough that like there are lots of, from what I've heard, really good alternatives to it. I've never looked into them. I don't know anything about it, but I know that there's lots of competitors out there. So mm-hmm. I don't know if you're looking into those at all.
Well, you mean like Elasticsearch as a service, or you mean like Apache Solr?
Searching and indexing services in general.
Yeah, yeah. Because a lot of those, like the biggest one I think is Algolia. And obviously I've looked at that. And I, you know, maybe that's another discussion for another day. I have a lot of thoughts on that, you know, like I did Hasura. But there's Algolia, which is doing great things. They have a Vue tool, like they have Vue components you can use out of the box, and it's really well done, you know. So there are a lot of choices to be made up there. So I have kind of looked at things. I have looked at like Solr a little bit. I'm very familiar with Elasticsearch because I've used it on 3 different apps, and it's kind of comfortable, and I know it, and I know it can do the job well. So I don't know, for like something as a service, it would have to do a heck of a lot for me to go that route at this point, I think.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, it sounds like you've already kind of considered it, and especially if you have experience in it already and you already know off the bat that it's the right tool for the job. Like,
yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's funny enough, when I first got the MVP, the Rails app was using Elasticsearch.
Did you rip it out?
I ripped it out because, again, it was not ideal in how things are implemented. So there was too many moving pieces for one person. And I was like, I can do what they have Elasticsearch doing right now with Postgres with much less work. And then you're removing a moving piece, like a very big moving piece, because you're having to sync anytime data changes on a product index or whatever index, you have to sync that back. And so there was lots of moving pieces between there. And yeah, so I ended up stripping it out and going with Postgres. So it's kind of like full circle, but I'm not sorry that I did that.
No, I got you where you needed to be. And that's important. So that's cool. Good. Glad you have time to get back to it now, and it'll probably be way better.
Anyhow, yeah. So GraphQL, all the things, that's what's happening.
Oh yeah. So I just discovered this. So 5 minutes before the show started here, I found a new package on Hex called Speakeasy. According to the README, is, quote, middleware-based authentication and authorization for Absinthe GraphQL powered by Bodyguard. So for those who don't know, Bodyguard is a library that I wrote for Phoenix and Elixir that is just a really simple kind of behavior for authentication and, excuse me, authorization, not authentication, you know, what you can do. And and I designed Bodyguard to be I basically just rewrote 2.0 to better support Phoenix context and stuff. So the way Bodyguard works is you define your authorization rules as functions on a module, surprise, and you can, but the way it does, it just gives you helper functions so you can enforce those policies either at the controller level, if you want to, you know, kind of do it on the outer edge of your application, or you can enforce them kind of within your contexts themselves, within the actual application code. And so it kind of leaves it up to you.
Yeah.
There's a lot of debate over which is better and people prefer different things. So I just decided to support both. It's just functions. So whatever.
Yeah. We could do a whole show about this because I spent a lot of time agonizing over this, actually.
Yeah. Well, this guy wrote this Speakeasy thing, and I haven't played with it yet, but I just looked at the README, and it's pretty nice. It's a very good way of doing it. It integrates seamlessly with Bodyguard, and it also supports, you know, he shows how to use it, and then he also, you know, says, hey, you can use it, again, at your schema level, or you can use it at your context level, and he gives examples for both of those and helper functions. So
yeah.
And it's all just GraphQL stuff. So it's That's pretty cool. I think you should take a look at this. I need to do that as well.
Yeah, I will probably end up using this as soon as we get upgraded to Bodyguard 2. it's a card in Trello somewhere. It's fading slowly as the days go on. But yeah, no, this looks great. I ended up writing, so in the same vein, I have like a very simple module with functions for filtering. I have a very simple module with policy, like it's a policy module that also handles param authorization. So basically what this is doing is what I kind of set up for myself. And it's just a few couple of functions with pattern matching, and that's about it. So yeah, maybe we should talk about that, because I would like to hear your thoughts on what I am doing, because the code's being used now, whether I like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, we should, we'll save that for another show, but we should talk about that.
Well, as always, I spouted off a lot, and if anyone has any feedback, good or bad, I don't care, please let me know. If you know better than me, please let me know. If you have experience there in those areas, please let me know. And as always, we appreciate any sharing, any word of mouth sharing, any Twitter, whatever social media you're on. Any shares are awesome. Ratings and reviews are great. The more ratings and reviews we have in iTunes, that means that the more we're exposed to new audience and new people. And we love meeting new people, and we love talking to new people. So that would mean the world to us. I think there's already 50 there, which kind of blows my mind. But if you're so inclined, that would be awesome.
Yeah, and you can reach us. You can reach the show Twitter at DNC Show. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I'm Shrockwell. You can do SCHRCKWLL or SHRCKWLL. I grabbed both, and I redirected the SH one to my main one.
That's smart.
People are going to spell it wrong. It's okay. I don't blame you. Everyone does it.
Yeah. On top of that, we got our show notes. I do the show notes. If you have any questions, like I talk about sharing source code, just let me know, and I'm happy to put more source code in notes and spend some more time on that. But those are available at dnc.show. And they're also available on GitHub, which I'll put a link to in the show notes. But I put all of the markdown files on GitHub for all of our show notes.
Oh, you are? I didn't even know that. Yeah. That's cool. And we also post the show notes over on spectrum.chat. where you can have a real-time discussion with us about the show. They have channels in there for our show, as well as other development topics, Elixir, Nuxt, Phoenix, anything you want. It's over at spectrum.chat.
Yeah, and they also have job boards. So if you're looking for a job, looking to change jobs, just looking for greener pastures, I suppose, you could check those out at spec.fm/jobs. And I think that's all we got.
Cool, man. Well, I guess I will talk to you later.
I will talk to you in about 5 minutes, probably.
Bye.
Later.
Thanks again to DigitalOcean for sponsoring today's episode. DigitalOcean really is just the easiest cloud platform to run and scale your applications. Visit do.co/doesnot to sign up and receive a free $100 credit towards your next application. Again, that's free $100 towards DigitalOcean's effortless administration tools, robust compute, storage, and networking services, one-click app installs, and even monitoring and alerting services so you can sleep at night knowing that your application's running A-OK. Thanks.